Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hi, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name is Daniel, and today I'm really excited to be joined by Sophie Redlin. Sophie is a GP, anthropologist, and a filmmaker as well, who has particular interest in mental health and remote and expedition medicine. She works as a GP in London, and as well as doing sort of traditional GP work, helps with service for homeless patients in Soho, and she's also worked as an expedition doctor all over the world, recently supporting sailing voyages to Antarctica and the Arctic. And then she's also involved in doing some research at UCL on different cultural approaches to mental health. So we're going to explore some of those ideas. Welcome, Sophie. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, really happy to be here.
Fantastic. So I guess today we're going to sort of delve into the theme of moral injury, and we've sort of chosen that based on an initiative that you've set up with some colleagues.
That's right, yes. This is a project that I've developed with two others, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess for people listening, it would be helpful to obviously have a think about what we mean by moral injury, but maybe we could explore as well how you developed this interest and why you set up the Moral Injury Partnership.
Of course, yeah. So as you kindly mentioned in the intro, I have a great interest in mental health, and that particularly flourished during my GP training when, as you'll know very well yourself, I began to see, you know, how much mental health we see in our everyday workload. And that really prompted me to take time out of training and explore mental health around the world, really, looking at different approaches to mental health, different mental health care tactics, etc. And during that period, I was awarded a Churchill Fellowship to go to the US, and I became very interested in Indigenous communities in the US and how they perceive mental health issues and how they cope with issues within their communities. And then back in beginning of the pandemic, so 2020, having just completed that fellowship, I was contacted by a guy called Simon Edwards, who's also a Churchill Fellow, and he'd done his research on mental health, but he was particularly looking at this issue of moral injury within the military. And actually, through conversations with him and through another Churchill Fellow, Alison O'Connor, we got together and began looking at the emerging issue of moral injury within healthcare workers, which of course became very obvious and prevalent during the pandemic. And in short, joined forces using our kind of collective research knowledge to put together an intervention for that.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that, yeah, it became sort of a more widely used term, didn't it, during COVID, as people sort of came to terms with facing things that were sort of completely or relatively unexpected at work and things. And I guess just to recap, what is moral injury?
Sure. So moral injury it's called the wound of service, which I think is a really good way of describing it. It's basically the impact, both emotionally and cognitively, of having to act in a way that goes against our moral compass, if you like. And that's usually due to systemic failings or structures, you know, above, out of our control. So it's really that wound that arises from having to care in a way, in the context of healthcare, to care in a way that doesn't sit well with us in terms of our own morals.
Yeah, and yeah, that whole concept of sort of systemic failings is obviously something that a lot of medics may be familiar with at the moment, given the state of sort of various healthcare systems. And I guess a lot of the research, from what you're saying, initially came out of the military, is that right?
That's right, absolutely. So, you know, examples from the military might include, you know, tragically, soldiers having to injure civilians in conflict zones, or, you know, act in ways that don't sit morally right with them. And as you touched on just then, you know, it became sort of more obvious to us in terms of examples during the pandemic for healthcare workers who in some ways were experiencing similar sorts of events. You know, for example, nurses in intensive care having to care for five patients when they would ordinarily have cared for one, and really being pushed out of that zone of what we feel morally comfortable with. But the reality is that moral injury has long existed within healthcare and many other sectors sort of long before the pandemic, and can, you know, continues obviously today in very different ways.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess step one is sort of identifying it and naming it and then defining it and things like that, as we've just been saying. But I guess once we're aware of it as an issue, is there anything we can do to sort of prevent it or prepare better for it? Is that sort of an individual thing or more of a systems-wide thing, do you think?
Absolutely. I think, of course, there's a huge systemic element to this. But I do think, and of course there are things, although we often feel helpless and powerless when it comes to making systemic changes, obviously as the strikes going on at the moment show, there are kind of collective movements that we can all join and hope will have some influence. But I think crucially there is a lot that we can do on an individual level. And as, you know, collective groups of medics or nurses or whoever in terms of healthcare. And I think for me, it's particularly about how do we prepare for moral injury and how can we look at potentially preventing it? And when I think about preparation, I think about, you know, really medical education. Are we having conversations enough in medical education, in nursing training, around what it's like to be in situations that don't feel morally right? You know, I don't know about you, but I don't remember any conversations in medical school about what it feels like when a patient dies and you're on call, or, you know, I'm being dramatic here, but this is a lot of our workload, particularly as junior doctors. Yeah. And yet there's not enough conversation around that. And it's not about fear-mongering, but it's about, as you say, raising awareness and having those conversations early. And then I think in terms of prevention, it's really on an individual level for me about trying to alleviate the shame of moral injury. So I'll probably talk quite a lot in our conversation about how really one of the core emotions of moral injury is shame. It's something that really isolates us because we don't feel we can talk about mistakes we've made or difficult situations we've been in. And the way to alleviate shame, as you know, is to tell each other our experiences, to share those experiences and realize that we're not the only one who feels like that. So I think in terms of prevention on an individual level and on a kind of grassroots ground level, it's about facilitating spaces where people can have those conversations more regularly in order to alleviate that shame and really build people's resilience in knowing that they're not alone and we're all in this together.
Yeah, some particularly valid points there. Yeah, I guess first off, yeah, I can't recall having much, if any, teaching at medical school, maybe a little bit through sort of postgraduate GP training, but yeah, still not that much. And I guess part of the challenge, yeah, talking about it is definitely the way forward, isn't it? Like it is for so many things. But I suppose first off, finding time for it is a challenge, isn't it? In our workspaces and things, but also I suppose creating an environment where it's safe to be vulnerable and safe to talk about these things can also be, you know, it's not easy to talk about how you feel, particularly when it's to your peers, you know, at times. And have you had any sort of thoughts and perhaps through the partnership you're creating about, you know, how we can address these ideas?
Absolutely. And I think it's such a good point that you've said that it's not easy to talk about how we feel. And I would say that really part of the groundwork for this is acknowledging and understanding the stigma that exists, particularly within medicine, around vulnerability being some kind of weakness. I mean, that's an issue that's widely talked about now in our society.
Yeah.
But I would argue that there are still fields such as medicine and such as the expedition world that we're both involved in, where there is still this need to keep calm and carry on. to be tough enough. I think that's fair. And therefore, we have to understand that kind of stigma really puts up a barrier to people speaking out and to reaching out for help. So as you say, I think it's about normalizing these conversations. And yes, in terms of ideas, much of what I've learned from my research really has been about community talking practices. So how do you create these spaces where people can remove themselves from perhaps a professional hierarchy and simply be a human being in a circle sharing a story? And how can we translate that into perhaps a healthcare setting or an expedition setting? And the thing is that none of this is rocket science or anything magical. If you look at, for example, the example of Balint groups, which I'm sure you're familiar with, a kind of talking, reflective group, initially created for GPs, but something that's quite rarely done now in my experience, that is an example of a very good model for GPs getting together once a week, reflecting on difficult cases, feeling that sort of shared resonance. So I think for me, it's about accepting that we've got to a position where these conversations aren't happening as naturally as they should be. And therefore, we need to slightly formally introduce these spaces, get people talking, and hope that organically these things continue.
Yeah, really interesting that you mentioned hierarchy, because I think that certainly comes into it, doesn't it? And I suppose linking the hierarchy with the fear of, I suppose it's the fear of looking a bit stupid, isn't it? And saying something or feeling something, which is obviously valid for an individual, but then the group can potentially perceive you in a different way afterwards, which is not how it should be at all. But have you had any ideas on how to sort of address that? I guess, like you say, it's partly formalizing it, partly setting kind of ground rules and looking at sort of how that goes and things. But I suppose for people who are thinking of trying to start similar groups or similar movements in their own places of work, do you have any suggestions for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So much of what I've learned, I've put into our project. So as you touched on at the beginning, set up this partnership called Moral Injury Partnership with Simon and Alison. Simon is an ex-military veteran who's done a lot of work with young soldiers and PTSD and coaching over the years. And Alison is a therapist who's a long time worked in psychotherapy and training at universities and brings a sort of creative arts therapy kind of expertise to our project. And the sort of gold, the main focus of our work is a retreat program that we've developed, which is a residential 3-day retreat for health and social care workers who are experiencing moral injury or burnout. And the program really has been formed through all of our experiences. But in terms of these talking spaces, I'm very much respectfully using techniques that I've picked up along my research journey. And really the key to it, as you say, is achieving an atmosphere where people can come and remove their professional hat and be there together as human beings. And there are various ways of achieving that. I think for me that the main thing, as you say, is creating a safe space. So really kind of outlining what the space is for, what it is not for. Secondly, finding ways that people can connect to that space as a human opposed to as a nurse or doctor. So we often do things, for example, allow people to introduce themselves through bringing an object to the circle or telling the story of an ancestor or, something like that that introduces them as a person rather than as a professional. But the key to it, and I think the thing that I would encourage anyone setting up these kind of spaces to think about, is to really get back to the basics of how do we tell stories to each other and how do we listen to stories. So before I start these talking circles on the retreat, we do a session around conversation skills, which sounds really, really basic. But the reality is that a lot of us have forgotten or not really learned how to share a story. How do we know what to share, what not to share? How do we know to keep ourselves safe? How do we know to listen well? how do we know to, how to respond to a story without jumping in, without offering advice, etc. So as I say, it's very, very basic stuff, but actually if that right space is created, it can be really powerful. And I've certainly witnessed that on our pilot retreat last year.
That's really interesting for me. I like the idea of introducing yourself with an object or something like that and delabeling people. That can, that sounds like it can be really, really beneficial. And interesting what you're saying about learning, almost kind of relearning how to have a conversation. Because I suppose now we're very much like, certainly at work, very much like analysing as we're conversing. We want that information, we want it now. And it's very easy, particularly with people who are telling stories or experiences, to kind of, it's not quite normalise it, but to frame it within your own kind of paradigm and be like, oh, yeah, I've experienced that. Which is not the purpose of why the other person is talking, is it? And that can kind of devalidate their experiences as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it's something we all do. And particularly, as you say, I think when we're in that clinician role, you know, as a GP, for example, you have a very set agenda to that history taking or to that initial question of how are you? And so it's, yes, it's about either relearning or learning for the first time. Well, how do I provide a safe space for this person sharing their story? And actually, often that's, you know, very much just giving them time and perhaps responding, thank you for telling me that. You know, very little else is needed. And yet I think particularly as clinicians, we want to fix people, don't we? We want to provide solutions. Mm. We get anxious when we can't provide a solution or fix an issue. So yes, it's about giving someone that space and, as you say, that validation. And really often that's all, the real healing then comes from someone feeling they've been able to say something difficult for the first time and having others acknowledge it. It's, you know, it's crazy how powerful that is.
Yeah, no, it's that's very, very true, isn't it? And you mentioned obviously the pilot retreat. I take it you're planning on sort of running more in the sort of in the future, are you?
We are. We've actually sort of in your neck of the woods. We've got some funding from the Welsh National Lottery a few months ago to run two further retreats. So our first one will be at the end of November, the 23rd, and the second one in February. And so we're very, very happy about that. It's long been a goal of ours.
Fantastic, yeah.
Thank you. We want to keep these retreats accessible to everybody. So it's important to us that people aren't paying a lot of money to come, because I don't believe that, you know, well-being should be a luxury or a kind of indulgence in this way. I think this healing is sort of needed for everybody. So yes, yeah, so we're running two further retreats. We've really grateful to be working in collaboration with Durham University, so the Moral Injury Centre there, and they're helping us look at evaluation at the moment and how we can, you know, effectively continue the sort of therapeutic impact of the retreat and not intrude on that, but also gather evidence as to, you know, is this methodology working in order to sort of expand further. And our dream and our hope really is to start building relationships with trusts where we can encourage trusts to actually take on this work and offer these places to staff that are struggling, particularly potentially staff who've been off work with burnout, etc. And then we're also now moving into more prevention work, so giving talks and workshops to training groups. I'm really excited to be delivering some training to GP training groups in London around moral injury, and also looking to kind of medical education and nursing training as well.
That sounds fantastic. I guess, yeah, it's addressing that gap that we were talking about earlier, when neither of us had really had much in training. And I think that sounds like a really good plan to try and get, as we all know from health, isn't it? Prevention is the best thing, but certainly linking up with trusts as well and sort of trying to get people who are suffering from burnout and things to sort of get involved. And we've mentioned burnout a few times. It's kind of one of those, burnout and resilience, isn't it? There's some of the buzzwords floating around at the moment. I suppose in terms of that, for people who maybe don't have the time to attend one of these retreats and things, have you found through your research, and I suppose, you know, also your research looking at how other cultures look at storytelling, mental health, these sorts of things, any sort of useful tips that you can give people listening to sort of help combat burnout and improve resilience? I know we could do a whole kind of multi-day session on this, but and any thoughts on that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, burnout, as you say, is very much a buzzword. I think it's an easier word potentially to use, in the same way that, as we know, patients will often find it easier to describe their symptoms or their feelings as stress rather than something else. Burnout, I think, therefore, unfortunately, can be underestimated in terms of the impact that it can have, you know, on a public health and workforce basis. It can be huge. I mean, the percentage of people who are off work at the moment with burnout is huge in the NHS, as you know. But on an individual level, as you say, it can be devastating for people. I think what we do know, what is talked about, are the links between burnout and mental health issues such as depression, anxiety. But what we talk less about, again, are these emotions of shame and guilt that are often related to burnout. And these really shouldn't be underestimated. I mean, we know through research that shame is one of the core determinants of suicidal thoughts in people. So, you know, this is a huge issue. And really at the core of burnout, I think it's total emotional and physical exhaustion, but it also comes hand in hand with people really doubting who they are and why they're doing what they do when at one point, you know, that calling felt very strong. So I think in terms of combating that, it's about really on a kind of wider systemic level, I think, again, acknowledging not only the physical toll of what we do, but the emotional toll as well, and trying to provide more support for that where it's possible, and really placing much more emphasis on staff well-being. I mean, you look around the world to countries, particularly Scandinavian countries, for example, that really prioritize staff well-being in a much bigger way than we do. And the reality of this is that makes health services sustainable. We see kind of staff well-being as the bottom of the priority list. But really, if you place value on that and you invest in your staff, you keep people in the workforce who are passionate about what they do and have years of experience. And that was what I would say to any government without getting political.
It is. Strange that, isn't it? Like, strange how that message doesn't seem to get through. But I guess, we could go sort of super political, but I suppose, it's difficult in terms of finances and, time and things like that. But those shouldn't be excuses, because as you say, it is super important, and it will help retain workforce, which is ultimately what people want, isn't it? Just sort of sidestepping a bit, in terms of we've sort of thought about kind of burnout and mental health, and I suppose at times, it's like you said, people are using labels perhaps that are more accepted with less stigma and things to maybe help them and help them feel sort of more accepted at work. And I mean, that's difficult, isn't it? I think stigma is improving around mental health, but there's probably still a fairly long way to go, isn't it? I just thought it would be interesting, because I know you recently did a presentation on mental health, but looking at it more from sort of Indigenous people's perspectives at the Royal Geographic Society. And I just wondered what sort of things you'd found in your role more of an anthropologist with regards to sort of mental health, thinking more globally.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So again, as we've just said, difficult to sum up in a few minutes, but I've kind of managed to summarise that, I guess, into three main takeaways from that bit of research. So as I mentioned earlier, I was lucky enough to spend some time with American Indian and Alaska Native communities in the US. Mm. And at the moment, I'm working with a community in Canada, First Nation community.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I guess one of the main differences in terms of how we view health, and this is largely generalizing, obviously, and there are many differences between these communities, but largely it would be fair to say that many of these kind of traditional communities view health in a much more holistic way. And that's often viewed through the context of sort of a sense of spirituality. So, you know, our connections to nature, our connections to our past, our future, our planet around us, etc. And when it comes to health, that's important because it means that there's less of this separation or differentiation between mental and physical health, or, you know, psychological health, spiritual health, etc. And therefore, the repercussions of that are that if you view health as one big circle rather than little segments of a pie, it means that you're much more accepting of how cultural change, societal change, social change impacts your mental health and well-being. And therefore, they're much more open, or certainly in my experience, the communities I've worked with approaching mental health from a much more holistic point of view. So, for example, when it comes to depression, it may not be just a question of does this person need medication? It's likely going to be a question of, well, what's this person's community like? What's potentially happened to them in terms of historical trauma? What might that healing look like for them? So you can see that automatically that creates a very different perspective. And I think opens the doors to many other approaches that are very effective in terms of managing these issues. Other few points, and I'll try and be quick on this, but secondly, and this is a huge thing, isn't it, but the importance of community. So really community central to healing in lots of these cultures, and native and ceremony, which takes very different forms depending on which community you're in, but ceremony is a way of bringing people together in order to really harness that community healing. And in some ways, when we talk about balance groups and talking circles, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the energy of a group to support each other. And then the last thing, but crucial, obviously, to the work that I'm doing is, yes, the role of storytelling in healing. And, you know, in all the months I've spent with these communities, I think that's probably been the biggest takeaway, that sharing our experiences with others, having other people listen and respond in a meaningful way is incredibly powerful, and I think is a tool that we could utilize much more than we do.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating, isn't it? I suppose, like you say, it's like going back to the basics and doing things that on the surface don't sound that difficult, but in reality can be challenging to sort of get going, I guess, isn't it? And I suppose some of the things are transposing ideas in certain communities and environments into, say, you know, inner city London, for example, and that there's bound to be some challenges there. But do you think it's possible to sort of use some of these ideas, and have you sort of tried suggesting them to patients as well? Because we've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about healthcare staff, but I think a lot of what we're talking about is also good for, you know, either patients that we're seeing in GP surgeries, hospitals, or as we touched on earlier, out when we're in the wilderness on expeditions as well.
Yes, definitely, absolutely. Yes, the obvious first barrier or obstacle would be to say, well, yeah, you know, we can't transpose a cultural practice to a completely different community. And that's very true. But the answer I always give to that question is that the core values that underpin a lot of these practices are universal to all humans. So the power of talking to each other, sitting in a group, this isn't unique to an American Indian community, and they'd be the first to say that. You know, many of these ceremonies actually were being performed by, you know, the ancient Celts back in the year whatever, you know, so our ancestors in the UK. Yeah. So yes, I think in terms of translating a lot of this stuff, particularly as you say, to somewhere like London, is really about understanding, well, what is the dynamic of the community already, and how do we acknowledge where we're at and work with that? So something I've observed in indigenous health systems abroad is using these kind of traditional methods within health systems. So, for example, having a series of talking circles that run alongside clinical sessions where the community can actively support each other. And I think that for me is potentially the future of this kind of work. So we cannot expect people to just suddenly start supporting each other in communities again, or to suddenly start having better conversations when they've never learned. We need to provide a vehicle to doing that. And while people still have some trust in the health system, I think healthcare can be a voice for that. But we need to, you know, start that work ourselves. And I think just to touch briefly on what you've talked about, the expedition setting, yes, as you know, I've also been working to bring a lot of this research into expedition medical training. And I actually find the expedition environment a really good environment for sort of testing a lot of these methods. So how do we create talking spaces while we're on expedition, for example, that we can use to support people struggling, you know, when they're in remote environments, that we can use to resolve conflicts within teams, etc. And so I think, as I say, a lot of these practices and principles are very applicable to that kind of setting too.
Yeah, they certainly are, aren't they? Because I think we dwell a lot of the time on, well, on various different medical courses and conferences and things about sort of the, you know, the sexy trauma, the altitude, you know, different extremes of temperature. But a lot of the times it is personal relationships, sort of the dynamics, the way teams kind of work. And yeah, a lot of mental health and all these challenges that all get sort of thrown in together in kind of this wilderness community. But I guess that's the key bit there is the fact that we're essentially setting up mini communities, aren't we, when we go off into the wilderness and go on expeditions. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of space to try some of this. Have you got any research plans specifically looking at, you know, expedition wilderness medicine at all?
I don't have any research specifically planned, but I have developed some training that I'm happy to share and teach on various courses. Shout out to Lucy Oblensky, who I know you know as well, who's running her courses with Endeavour Medical. Yeah. And I've been really happy to work with her in teaching kind of mental health stuff. But then also on the expeditions that I've been on myself. So I've done some work with a tall ship charity called Seize Your Future, where we're looking at using kind of regular talking spaces on the ship as a way of allowing the young people who are sail training to kind of self-manage. And then one of the strongest tools that I think I've developed from this work is something called the emotional kit list. So again, thinking about, just as you've highlighted, how we often sort of focus mostly on physical risk assessment and physical health in the field, but how do we now expand that to include our emotional needs? And so really it's a very simple tool, simple framework for again using this sort of more indigenous holistic way of looking at health and thinking about how can we anticipate emotional challenges in the field.
Yeah,
and
that's,
you know,
that's great, isn't it? Like an emotional risk assessment almost.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, and then that's again a tool that we can bring back to our everyday lives as well.
That's I really like that, actually. That's definitely something. Yeah, because you don't really get that in any risk assessments you're doing. But there's that human element that, and maybe it's like you say, maybe we do need to go back to being more sort of holistic in general.
Absolutely. I mean, that would be my dream for the future.
Fantastic. Well, it's been really great to chat, and I know we could dig down into some of these ideas and talk for a lot longer, but. Yeah, it's been great to have you on the podcast. I've really enjoyed sort of discussing some of those ideas, and we could have had a lot longer chat, I'm sure, about a lot of these areas. But I'll put the link to any sort of websites you've got or to help people book onto these retreats, and I hope they all go really well. I look forward to kind of hearing about them, and maybe I'll pop along and say hello if you're up in Wales as well. So great to have you on the podcast, and thanks so much.
That'd be great. Thanks so much, Daniel. Really nice to speak to you.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.